Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavad Gita, chapter number 7, Knowledge of the Absolute, text number 7. Mata parataram na anyat kinchit asti dhananjaya mai sarvam idam pratam sutre manigana iva. Mata parataram nanyat kinchid asti dhananjaya mai sarvam idam protam sutre mani gana iva. Mata, beyond me. Parataram, superior. Na, not. Anyat kinchit, anything else. Asti, there is. Dhananjaya, O conqueror of wealth. Mai, in me. Sarvam, all that be. Idam,
which we see.
Protam, is strung. Sutre, on a thread. Mai gana, mani gana, pearls. Iva, like. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O conqueror of wealth, there is no truth superior to me. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. Purport. There is a common controversy whether the supreme absolute truth is personal or impersonal. As far as Bhagavad Gita is concerned, the absolute truth is the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. And this is confirmed in every step. In this verse in particular, it is stressed that the absolute truth is a person, that the personality of Godhead is the supreme absolute truth, is also the affirmation of the Brahma Samhita. Ishvaraha paramaha krishnaha satchirananda vigraha. That is, the supreme absolute truth, the personality of Godhead, is Lord Krishna, who is the primeval Lord, the reservoir of all pleasure, Govinda, and the eternal form of complete bliss and knowledge. These authorities leave no doubt that the Absolute Truth is the Supreme Person, the cause of all causes. The impersonalist, however, argues on the strength of the Vedic version given in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad 3.10. Tato yad uttarataram tad arupam anamayam ya etad vidur amritaste bhavanti atetare dukam evapiyanti. Note the word arupam. They like that word arupam. Rupam means form, and arupam They say means without form. But that's their misinterpretation. It actually means with no material form. Here's the translation. In the material world, Brahma, the primeval living entity within the universe, is understood to be the supreme amongst the demigods, human beings and lower animals. But beyond Brahma, there is the transcendence, who has no material form and is free from all material contaminations. Anyone who can know him also becomes transcendental. But those who do not know him suffer the miseries of the material world. The impersonalist puts more stress on the word avrupam. But this avrupam is not impersonal. It indicates the transcendental form of eternity, bliss, and knowledge, as described in the Brahma Samhita quoted above. Other verses in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad 3, 8, and 9 substantiate this as follows. Vedaham metang purusham mahantam adityavarnam tamasa parastat tameva vidvan atimrityumeti nanyapantad vidyate yanaya yasmatparam naparam ostikinchid yasman naniyo na jayo stikinchit viksha iva stobdo devitishtantyekas tanedam purnam purushena sarvam. I know that Supreme Personality of Godhead who is transcendental to all material conceptions of darkness. Only he who knows him can transcend the bonds of birth and death. There is no way for liberation other than this knowledge of that Supreme Person. So this is in exactly the same book, the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. So if the Mayavadis want to squeeze out an impersonal understanding for avrupam, it's totally out of context of the entire work, the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Because here clearly it's describing the Supreme Person. And then the second verse of that is translated, there is no truth superior to that Supreme Person because he is the supermost, he is smaller than the smallest, and he is greater than the greatest. He is situated as a silent tree, and he illumines the transcendental sky. And as a tree spreads its roots, he spreads his extensive energies. From these verses, one concludes that the Supreme Absolute Truth is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is all-pervading by his multi-energies, both material and spiritual. Om Jnanatimarandasya Gunam Janashalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmaishi Gurave Namah. The impersonalists have an agenda. They don't come with an open mind to hear the Vedas. You see. Just like in the courtroom, you see, you hire an attorney. And when he appears before the judge to make his case, he comes with an agenda to make sure that his client wins. His client could have murdered someone. And he knows it. The attorney knows it. But he argues that his client is innocent, you see. He takes the law books, he takes all the facts and figures he can get, and he plays with them. He manipulates them to put forward his agenda, which is to defend his client. He's not an open-minded seeker of justice. He's a paid liar, basically, who can manipulate the law books and the facts concerning the incidents to make it appear that his client is innocent. You see, that's called professional lawyer or liar, professional liar. So the Mayavadis do not come to the Vedas humbly saying, please enlighten me. They come to the Vedas with an agenda. They want to establish that God is impersonal. And they look for any little things they can use, even if it's taken out of context, to put forward their impersonal agenda, that God has no form. This is not simply something in the textbook. I'm getting letters from them. In my e-course, I'm getting emails all the time from impersonalists. It happens regularly. Well, not every day, but I do get some heavy, heavy impersonalists who are trying to establish that God is impersonal, who are trying to completely destroy this idea that God could be a person. They say that the absolute truth is nirguna. It has no qualities, and that the saguna Brahma, which they call sadhu, Brahman with qualities, is this material world. You see? That's what they argue. That nirguna Brahma is the original spirituality. And when that original nirguna Brahma then manifests the material world, this material world is the saguna Brahman, or the Brahman that has qualities. You see? Qualities only exist in the material realm. In the spiritual realm, there are no qualities. It is nirgun. Gun means quality, sa means with, and nir means without. So they argue that the material realm is the saguna Brahman, and the spiritual world is the nirguna Brahman. That's their argument. But actually, there's no such thing as something without qualities. To describe something as being nirguna, that's a qualitative statement. So actually, qualitativelessness, doesn't exist. There's no such thing as qualitativelessness. Because to say something is without qualities, that is a qualitative state, you see. That describes it. Well, it has no qualities. That in itself is a qualitative state. So, that original Brahman must possess qualities. Why? It is impossible to derive qualities from that which has no quality. Everything that we see possesses, everything that we experience has some quality to it. Do we have any experience that something qualitative comes from something that has no quality? Or to put it another way, do we have any experience that something with form is produced by something that has no form? Or as the analogy we gave on our last preaching tour, can you get gold out of a mine that has no gold in it? You see? If I tell you I have a gold mine and it's, you know, every day I bring you 1 kilo of gold. Say, I brought you some gold today from the mine. And finally one day, you're becoming fabulously rich from all these kilos of gold I'm bringing you every day. Finally you say, Sankarshan Prabhu, where are you getting all this gold? Are your disciples giving it to you, or what's happening here? You know, where is all this gold coming from? And I have this mine, and it has unlimited gold in it. Oh, really? No, but if I tell you, I have this mine, but it doesn't have any gold in it, you see, that wouldn't make any sense. If I'm getting unlimited gold out of a mine that has no gold, that's absurd. So, the original source of everything, the original source of all of unlimited varieties of qualities, that original source must have quality. So therefore, when we hear the term nirguna, are its similar term of rupa without form, it has to mean it has no material qualities and has no material form. It has to mean that. The other meaning is not really possible. It's even logically. What to speak of when we take it in the context of the other verses in the exact text, same book, the Svetashvatara Upanishad, which affirm the personality of Godhead. So the Mayavadis love to take things out of context to put forward their agenda. We must defeat them. The more we can defeat these Mayavadis, the more we make advancement in Krishna consciousness. So we should all become very knowledgeable how to defeat Mayavadi philosophy. For one reason, we all have certain degrees of Mayavadi contamination within us. Growing up in this Prabhupada's second mantra, we pray, Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvisheshu Shunyavadi Pushcharcha Desha Tadine. These Western countries, which are so full with impersonalism and voidism, you see. So, those of us who have grown up here in the West, even in India, it's also very bad. That's where it's coming from, but it's in greatly infected. It's all over the world. So it's confirmed that in these Western countries, this Mayavadi influence of thinking, yes, I am God, it is a very strong influence. So we have to become free from this Mayavadi contamination by understanding how to defeat Mayavadi philosophy. If for no other reason, just to defeat the Mayavadi within our own hearts. And from time to time, we will run into people who openly espouse Mayavadi philosophy, as Prabhupada is giving their argument here. So we should be prepared to defeat the Mayavadi within and the Mayavadis without, external Mayavadis. They are enemies of the personality of Godhead. They want to negate his identity as a person. Actually, an honest atheist is better. He simply says, I don't believe in God. But the Mayavadis, when they say, yes, come to our ashram. We are a God-centered society. We are spiritualists. We believe in God and the divinity of everything. Come on and join our ashram. Then once you join, you find out, well, God has no form. God has no personality. I'm God, you're God, and we're all God. And that's their God. Impersonal God. It's better to have been an atheist than to have some impersonal conception. And at least an atheist is honest. He says, I don't believe in God. But the Mayavadi says, I believe in God, but I'm God, and you're God, and we're all God. That's a more dangerous position. It's a very dishonest position to take. They've invented some false conception of God, and that they promote. This verse is an amazing verse, actually. Simply amazing. Krishna says, everything rests upon me as pearls are strung upon its web. Many people write me, they say, how can I be Krishna conscious when I go to my job, my office? This is one of those verses you can use to be Krishna conscious if you have to go to an office somewhere. Even, you know, for those who live in ashram, the same thing. All of us can use this verse. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung upon its bed. So, it's like you can look out the window. You know, the hills, the mountains, the snow. Or you can look at this room. You can look at anything. And you can understand this is only able to be here. Krishna is the thread which is running through all of it. If you pull the thread out of a string of pearls, what happens? They're finished. That string of pearls is finished. It just scatters everywhere, disintegrates. So if you pull Krishna, if you take Krishna, you take this material world minus Krishna, there's nothing left. There's nothing left. Your Germany, finished. You see, our United States of America, finished. Your European Union, finished. Your Volkswagen, you know, everything, finished. You pull that string up, everything finished. Krishna is the string running through everything which is holding it together. Your material body, finished. Even your spiritual existence would be finished if it were not for Krishna, who's maintaining you at every minute by his sweet desire to reciprocate love with you. And that's why we are such rascals that we do not love Krishna. He's giving us our very identities. He's giving us everything, all facility, just for the purpose of having a loving relationship with us, but we are turning our back on him. We are saying, I am God. I am the enjoyer. I am the center. You see? You may say, but I don't claim that I'm God. But you act like you're God. Roundabout way, you're claiming that you're God. Because you act like your enjoyment is the number one principle of this world. Not God's enjoyment, your enjoyment. So we have to realize that this propensity to want to be the enjoyer will kill us. It will kill us. One disciple just wrote me from Texas. She said that, Gurudev, you know, I know I'm not supposed to be the enjoyer, but I know I'm not the enjoyer, but how do I give up this? How do I give this up? This enjoying propensity is so strong. How can I enjoy without breaking any principles? She was asking. And the real answer is by being in the mood of service. You see, always want to give service. Serve the Vaishnavas, serve the spiritual masters, serve Srila Prabhupada's mission, serve ISKCON, you see, serve Krishna. Always being in the mood of giving service, giving pleasure to Krishna. Many people say, well, I chant Hare Krishna, but I'm not enjoying it. There must be something wrong with the mantra, because I don't enjoy it. But the real fact is, it's not for your enjoyment. You are meant to chant Hare Krishna to give enjoyment to Krishna. That's why you're meant to do it. You may argue, but Prabhu, Prabhupada said, chant and be happy. I agree, he did. But you have to know how to be happy. That's the point I'm making. If you just try to enjoy the name without serving the name, forget it. You may think you're enjoying the name, but it won't last. If you want to really enjoy the name, then you have to be in the mood of service. And that's the key. If you want to give pleasure to Krishna, you want to give pleasure to your spiritual master, if you want to give pleasure to the Vaishnavas, you see, then you will get pleasure. Then you will get unlimited oceans of pleasure. This is another one of those insider secrets. Don't try to enjoy Krishna. Try to give enjoyment to Krishna, and then you will enjoy. Always put Krishna first, not yourself. And then, when you've truly done that, your pleasure will be on an equal level with God. Even greater level than God, devotee can enjoy. Why did Krishna become Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? He saw that my devotee, Srimati Radharani, she is enjoying more than me. What is this? I am supreme enjoyer, but here is this devotee, she is enjoying serving me more than I am enjoying being served by her. Wait a minute. I'm missing out on something here. I think I'll become a Hare Krishna. So Krishna decided to join the Hare Krishna movement. Bhakta. Bhakta Avatar. He joined the Bhakta program. Bhakta Avatar. That's the name for Lord Chaitanya, Bhakta Avatar. Lord Chaitanya, the Supreme Lord appearing in the form of Bhakta. Bhakta Avatar. So Bhakta Avatar, he joined the Bhakta program. To taste the bliss of Krishna consciousness, of being a Vaishnava, being a devotee. So there is truly no greater happiness than being a devotee. It exceeds anything of this material world. We sometimes may think, oh, I gave up so much by becoming a devotee. I could have stayed in corporate Germany and worked my way up the ladder and have so much money. Or, you know, we may lament different things. I should have done this or that. But don't ever think that way. By giving your life to Krishna, you're achieving a position beyond even that achieved by the demigods. Pure devotional service is very, very, very rare. It's the greatest opulence that one can ever possess. So make this endeavor to fully surrender to Krishna. Give up all material desires. Simply desire how I can please my spiritual master, how I can please Krishna, and how I can please the Vaishnavas. And then your life will be supremely successful. You will never experience anxiety or fear ever again. This is our Krishna consciousness movement. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yeah.
I want to know if there is a difference between jiva, between soul and spiritual body of jiva.
Is there a difference between the spiritual soul, the soul and the spiritual body?
In the material world, your body and the self are different. But in the spiritual world, the spirit soul and the spiritual body are one and the same. In the material world, you are not your body, and in the spiritual world, you are your body. It's different. There's no difference between the spiritual body and the self in the spiritual world. Just as the spirit soul is eternal, full of knowledge and bliss, your spiritual body is also eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. It never gets old, it never gets sick, and it never dies. But it's also a very mystical thing. If one wants to, one can actually change one's... One can assume different bodies to serve Krishna in different ways. It's described by Prabhupada. But the original spiritual body of everyone is a human form. Even the non-human devotees actually have ultimately human forms, but they're taking these other forms to serve Krishna in different ways. Prabhupada explains that. But the original form of the spirit soul is human form. Two arms, two legs, two eyes, two nostrils, one mouth. That is the original spiritual form. Questions? Questions more?
But it is also said.
Hmm?
But it is also said when an example is also given that.
Speak louder.
Let me put it in the right words. It is said that when one becomes a devotee in the material world, his body also transforms into spirit.
Hmm. Even now in this material world, when you engage your gross material body consisting of Bhumer, Rupo, Nalo, Vayu, Kangmun, the five gross elements, even now this material body becomes spiritualized, but it's different from the spiritual body in the spiritual world, which is composed of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. It's a spiritualized body. But it's not, still, you will leave these material elements behind. The spiritualized material elements will merge back into one of three things according to your tradition. If you're a Hindu, as it's stated by Prabhupada, for the Hindu it means your body will become ash because they cremate. If you're a Parsi, you'll become stool because they feed the dead to the vultures. When you die, they throw you to the vultures. Parsis. And if you're a Christian, they will bury you and you will turn into ashes in the coffin. So, even if you're a devotee, well, you know, you could be buried. Some, like the spiritual masters are buried. Sannyasis. You could be, you know, cremated, which normally we do. So that material body will become dust or become ashes. But the spirit soul will actually penetrate the thick coverings of the material universes and enter into Goloka Vrindavan, where that dormant spiritual body, which was not manifest because one had fallen into material existence, will become revived. And you will become reinstated in your original spiritual activities, your original pastimes with Krishna will become once again manifest. Something to look forward to. Yeah.
I have a question. You said that we should get this serving attitude. This is the main thing. But sometimes it seems to be difficult to find out how we can serve Krishna best. So Prabhupada said we should have a spiritual master who can engage us properly to according to our capacities. And
Yes, it is stated that the spiritual master engages the disciple according to his propensity. That is mentioned in Prabhupada's book. But it's also a fact, that, as Prabhupada has taught us, that the disciple thinks, let me simply do whatever will please my spiritual master. So the proper mood for the disciple to think is, my propensities, that's all right, but first and foremost, I have to think, what will please my spiritual master. He has to lay aside thinking, well, I have to serve in this way because that's my propensity. See, the spiritual master's duty is to, as far as possible, to engage the disciples according to his propensity. But that's not the disciple, should not be the disciple's move. That I have to be engaged according to my propensity, Guru Dev. No. You suddenly think, Guru Dev, how can I please you? The disciple, on the disciple's side, he should be detached from his propensity. That's the, if you want to come to the position free of anxiety, as long as you're thinking, oh, I have to be engaged according to my propensity, I'm not being engaged according to my propensity, then you're in anxiety. But the fact is, I had a very good realization of this. One disciple wrote me the other day, and I realized when I was answering her email that we do so many different types of services. Some of them are according to our propensity and some are not. Let's face it. Some things we enjoy doing and some things are austerity for us to do. In each and every activity that you do in Krishna consciousness, try to make it perfect. Maybe something you enjoy doing, like playing the harmonium. Maybe something you don't especially relish, like cleaning the toilet. You see, but whatever you do in every activity, whether you're scrubbing the toilet, whether you're playing the harmonium, whether you're shoveling snow, you see, whatever it is, try to do it in a qualitative bhakti mood. Because as we explained, I think it was last night or this morning, one, the consciousness you develop in doing a certain activity for Krishna will then feed into the other activities. The idea is to bring yourself to a position where everything is your propensity. You see? In fact, one should take those things that you don't want to do, the things you detest the very most, take those as a very special blessing. Let me do this and learn how to relish it. Because if you do that, then Maya can never touch you. That means you can do anything for Krishna. 24 hours a day, you can go to any part of the world and do anything that Guru wants you to do. You're completely the transcendental, a Vaikuntha man, you see. Cultivate that mood. It's fun, actually, to train yourself to be able to be like that. That's an exciting thing. It's like in the military, they have the standard soldiers and then they have the elite soldiers, you see. The soldiers who are the most expert, they put them into the elite corps, they give them the best, the fanciest uniforms, the best food, the best prestige, you see, they're the elite, the, you know, they're like the Green Berets in the U.S. or the Rangers, different names. And Saddam Hussein had the Revolutionary Guard, you know, there's all these different elite soldiers. So you should train yourself to become like that, a very highly trained transcendentalist who could do anything and everything to please your spiritual master and the Vaishnavas. You see? That's an exciting thing, to train yourself to be like that. Take advantage of when you're engaged according to propensity and try to just, you know, do it with as much love as you possibly can, as much bhakti. And take advantage of those things you don't like doing. Try to do them in the same spirit. And before you know it, you'll have a taste for everything. Beginning, we didn't like that bitter melon, you see, that Indian bitter melon. We heard that Prabhupada loved it. So we developed a taste, and now we love it. Bitter melon. So actually learn how to relish those things that are bitter, taste bitter to you, you see, right now. Yeah.
Isn't it that if we want to be engaged only to a propensity or something I like, it's still I'm trying to relish myself?
Yeah. That's true. I mean,
instead of giving pleasure, it's still I am the center.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, I mean, in the beginning, that's, I mean, Prabhupada does say they do that. He said, like the college students, you know, engage them in doing what they like to do for Krishna. That's obviously, you have to get started somewhere. But then as you get purified, you have to, one has to realize what is devotional service. It means I'm acting for the pleasure of Krishna. I'm giving up my own likes and dislikes and simply serving, you know, aligning my thoughts, words, and deeds according to the likes and dislikes of Krishna. Whatever Krishna likes, that I will do, and whatever Krishna doesn't like, that I will not do. Period. You may say, well, that sounds like you're a robot. You've lost your freedom, you lost your independence, but that's not true. When you come to that position, to where you don't want to think, speak, or act anything that is contrary to the pleasure of Krishna, you know what happens? Do you know what happens when you reach that point? Krishna becomes your servant. That person who controls the entire universe agrees to become controlled by you. Yeah?
Like Arjuna.
Somewhere. Huh?
Like Arjuna.
Arjuna and Jashoda, yeah. Damodar Lila. That Damodar who has now come to Simhachala, who's up in our room, you see. He's controlled by Mother Jashoda. Those of you who have not come for darshan, Radha Damodar are here in their room. So, that Damodar, he's an Arjuna also, very good examples. In that, you can also be in that position of controlling God. If you agree to become completely controlled by God, every thought, every word, every deed, in all times, all places, in all situations, then he will very joyfully put himself under your control. Because he's been waiting for millions of lifetimes for you to come to that position where he can become your servant, actually. He wants to reciprocate with you like that. That's why you exist. Krishna wants to have the sweetest, most intimate, loving relationship with you possible. He's just waiting for you to come out of the clouds of Maya so that he can again love you unlimitedly. As you love him unlimitedly, he will love you unlimitedly. Questions more? If there are no further questions. Yes?
If we can have material attachments to spiritual master.
If we can we have material attachment to the spiritual master?
What would be an material attachment to the spiritual master? Sounds like the Mayavadi, though he has such a nice beard. As long as you, well, yes, being materially attached to the spiritual master means, like Prabhupada said, don't take the spiritual master like a dog, you see. If one takes a guru like a pet, I mean, I've seen it sometimes. People came forward to me and they said, oh, you're our guru, we want to offer you RT and this and that, just on and on, and here's an homage we wrote you, and they read this huge long thing. And then 2 weeks later, they found out that they found out what I wanted them to do as my disciples, and they gave me up. I told them I wanted them to be active members of ISKCON. And they said, well, we don't like ISKCON. So they decided to give me up, you see. So their attachment to me was material. They wanted someone like a pet dog, you know. Come here, guru. Nice, guru. Roll over, guru. Fetch this bone, guru. Like that. And their attachment was material. And they made such a big thing. We stayed with them. And this is being recorded, oh God. Okay. I can't. Can't put this one on the internet now, because they might by chance hear it. No. This one I won't be able to put on the internet tonight, unless we edit it out. But anyway, yeah, they took me like a pet. Their attachment was material. But if your mood is simply, I simply want to serve my spiritual master, I want to do nothing but totally give myself to him. I just want to please him for all of eternity, and that's completely spiritual. As long as you don't want him to be under your control, and you want to be under his control, then it's spiritual. But if you want him to be under your control, then that's material. Do you want to control him, or you want to be controlled by him? That's the test. Yeah, I'm going to convince Gurudev of this and that. I got all of my arguments ready. I'm going to convince him and, you know, try to manipulate him. You see, that's material. But you simply agree, no, I'm simply a blank slate and Gurudev can manipulate me however he wants.
If he will do what
that's spiritual.
If he I will accept him as a guru if he will do what I want.
If you will do what I want, Gurudev, then you can be my guru. No. Guru means where you surrender completely with no argument. That is guru. So, any other question? Yeah.
Does it mean that we must directly ask Guru how to please him?
Doesn't necessarily require that you directly ask. I mean, because you can hear his classes, you can read what he has written, you can understand from what he is preaching what will please him. Of course, if you have the opportunity to directly ask him, then that's very good. Prabhupada asked Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, that was the only question he ever asked him, actually. How can I please you? So if you have the opportunity to directly ask your spiritual master how I can please you, then by all means, do it. And be ready to do whatever he says. But if you didn't have the opportunity to directly ask him, then you can hear his recorded lectures or, you know, read what he has written, and you can know what will be pleasing to him. Mm. Yes.
Right. I don't know how to properly, you know, and just say it. So I say, I've read some about this one guru who was built also a lot of ashrams here in the West.
Can you hear what he's saying?
No.
Yeah, you speak loud enough so she can hear me. I'm half deaf, so if she can hear, then she'll amplify it for me.
Auf Deutsch sagen, dann kannst du sagen. Ja, ich frage mich nur, ob es ein ganzes Leben geopfert für Krishna ist eigentlich das perfekte Leben. Ich frage mich nur.
I still cannot hear you, so please come here.
Nein, ich frage mich nur, ich habe da so eine Idee zwischen Mahasamadhi und einfach nur ein spirituelles Leben und Opfern für Krishna. Das ganze Leben Opfern für Krishna ist eigentlich.
That was the question.
He's speaking German.
Could you hear what he said?
Also, ich weiß nicht, wie ich das sagen soll. Also, wenn ich mein Lebensziel als Mahasamadhi ansehe oder als höchste spirituelle Verwirklichung, dass ich irgendwie meine Chakras aktiviert habe und Wasser und Energie fließt und so, ist eigentlich das Gleiche, als wenn ich Krishna bewusst lebe, eine Gemeinschaft mit Krishna. You know, thoughts about the perfection of the yoga system, like becoming completely in samadhi, getting in samadhi by yoga system. Or just
becoming?
Getting in samadhi.
Samadhi.
Mahasamadhi.
Are you talking about the Ashtanga system? Nam, Yam, Niyam, Asana, Pratyahara, Dharana.
So chakras and all.
Eventually achieving samadhi by the yoga system? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you asked that, what is better? Why is it necessary to serve Krishna? Just do this chakras and this and that.
Okay, do other types of yoga. Why we need to serve Krishna? We can attain the samadhi.
Why can't we do the other types of yoga?
Yeah.
All right.
With that you can attain the samadhi.
Yes, yes. Actually, the mystic yoga system, sitting and, the pranayama, achahara, all these things, that was the Yuga Dharma in the Satya Yuga, when the lifespan was 100,000 years. Even today in India, if you go to Kumbh Mela, where the yogis come down from the Himalayas for Kumbh Mela, there are yogis there who are 300 years old. Because they slow down their metabolism by merging the incoming and outgoing breaths. They're able to extend their lifespan by doing that. But the point is, it's a very long, long, long process to achieve perfection through the Ashtanga system, the mystic yoga system. It takes thousands of years, actually, to achieve it. And if any step along the way, you can easily fall by the wayside also. There is a great yogi, his name is Vishwamrita Muni. He had gone all the way through the eightfold path, the eightfold rungs. He had come through yam, niyam, asana, pratyahara. He had come all the way to samadhi. And the king of heaven, Indradev, he noticed there's this yogi. He's achieved samadhi. He's becoming very powerful now. If he wants, he can actually occupy my post as the king of heaven. So he got very worried, and he sent one of the prostitutes of the heavenly kingdom. Her name was Menaka. He dispatched Menaka to the spot, the secluded place in the mountains where the yogi was meditating. And as soon as he heard the sound of her ankle bell, ching, ching, he said, "Oh, a woman has arrived on the scene. Let me check this out." And that was it, finished. His yoga was finished. So, unless one has bhakti, unless one has actually developed a loving relationship with the Supreme Lord, even if you come all the way to the level of bhakti, of samadhi in the mystic yoga system, because you have no ability to love on the spiritual platform, you're always in danger of coming back to the so-called love of this material world. We may try to deny our need for love through yoga, but the fact is, we crave love. We can't exist without it. They say love makes the world go round. We're all desiring loving relationship. So if you don't develop a loving relationship with the Supreme Person, if you try to become a Supreme Person yourself by yogic perfection, it's a very lonely world. I'm God, I'm God, I'm God. It's a very lonely world to be a powerful yogi. It's a very lonely world to be in. They generally come back down from the Himalayas and they try to show off their mystic powers, and they try to convince people that they are the Supreme Person, and they want to attract some followers, and then they fall down and have illicit sex with their disciples. So this is what happens. If you really want to become a yogi, then you practice bhakti yoga. Even if you do the Eightfold Path and you come all the way to samadhi, your samadhi will always remain imperfect until you can overcoat it with bhakti. So if bhakti is ultimately required even for the mystic yogi, the Ashtanga yogi, then why waste time? If you want to do asanas and pranayama for good health, that is alright. For doing bhakti, a healthy body is very good. So if someone is doing asanas and pranayama or whatever for good health, there is no harm. But do not think that in this age of Kali, in this lifetime, you can achieve perfection by doing it. It's not possible. To actually do that yoga system properly, you have to go to the forest. You can't live in a heated building. You have to be out in the forest and exposed to the elements all year long. We had one boy who came to our center in Austin. As soon as he graduated from college, he thought, "Now I will become a yogi." He went to New Mexico, went way up in the high in the mountains where it was very cold, and he took all his clothes off. He said, "Now I will sit and meditate." A few days later, they found him dead. He died. An exposure to the cold. You can't do those sort of yogic austerities unless you're properly trained. To actually achieve that yogic perfection requires proper training. Don't think you can do it on your own. You have to be very carefully and properly trained. You can kill yourself by doing it. We've seen. This boy died. His brother came and told us what had happened. He was coming to the Sunday feast, taking prasadam, but he went naked up into the mountains. I think I will become a yogi, and it killed him. Yes.
Wasn't this process was recommended in Satyuga, where the people lived like 100,000 years, and plus they were very pure. their mentality and all the way. So that was recommended.
Yeah, that system was in it for an age when people lived to be 100,000 years old. Valmiki Muni spent 60,000 years. Shingadeva Kija, he spent 60,000 years perfecting a yogic system. Can you guarantee you will live even 60 years? You see? 60,000 years it took Valmiki Muni to achieve yogic perfection through that system. 60,000 years. Even if you lived for 100 years lifespan, how many 100 years lifespans would it take? I mean, you'd have to, you know, you have to keep coming back again and again in the Kali Yuga. Let's say you could even through, you became an expert yogi, you could live up to 300 years. Let's say even 500 years. Divide that into 427,000 years left in the Kali Yuga. How many lifetimes would it take you? And as the Kali Yuga gets worse, you may be sitting there in the mountains doing your yoga. The Kali Yuga will get worse and they will all become cannibals. They'll come to the mountains to look for you and eat you later on in the Kali Yuga. So it's better to get out now when you have a chance. If you just do Bhakti Yoga for one lifetime, you can still do the asanas and the breathing for good health, no harm. But make your path for spiritual perfection Bhakti. Bhakti Yoga, Krishna consciousness. And then you can finish it up in this lifetime. Go back to home, back to Godhead. Become the greatest yogis. You can, you know, as you're going back to Godhead, you can look down at all the yogis in the Himalayas who are battling it out lifetime after lifetime, and you'll be going back. You'll become a more advanced yogi than all the yogis up there in the Himalayas right now who are living for hundreds of years by doing austere yoga practices. You'll become more advanced than all of them. Just by giving your life completely to Krishna. No. So we're asking you to do that. You totally surrender your life to Krishna. Is that all right?
Completely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
My question. You just said that if someone lives for 500 years in that yoga, but if I'm correct, when one fails in the yoga system, Ashtanga yoga system or meditation, one fails, they lose everything. All their
one what?
One loses all their austerities. Well, there is no reason, because they fail in and they have to start again from the beginning. Whereas in bhakti, we know that Krishna says,
you could lose it completely.
It happened with
There's also indication though, Bahunam Janmanam Ante, that you can go through a process birth after birth gradually.
Wouldn't that be that's bhakti yoga, that's
dhani. No,
that's
jnana. Yeah. Jnana Vanam Prapachate. So yeah, the fact is you risk losing everything anyway. You may develop great yogic power, but if your karma is such, you won't carry it to your next life. It could carry if by your karma you deserved it to carry, but if it doesn't, you won't even keep it. You'll lose it. This is a very good point. Whatever assets you may accrue in your yoga practice, you won't necessarily get them in your next lifetime. They may come in a different way. The piety, you know, the austerity you did, you may get it in a different way in your next lifetime. By becoming rich. And then you become entangled by sense enjoyment. So the best thing is you do bhakti, even if you don't perfect bhakti in this lifetime. Whatever bhakti you develop, that is guaranteed to carry over to your next lifetime. Absolutely guaranteed. If you advance to the point of 10% bhakti, then you'll start off at that level in your next lifetime. So whatever every little thing you do in bhakti, whether it's bowing down before the deity, whether it's nicely hearing the lecture, whether it's nicely chanting, whatever you're doing in bhakti, whether it's honoring prasadam nicely with love and devotion, whatever you're doing in Krishna consciousness, you're accruing spiritual assets moment by moment, minute by minute, hour by hour. You are building up your spiritual assets. And it'll reach a point where you'll have enough assets to buy your ticket to Goloka Vrindavan. You've saved up and you've got enough spiritual assets in your bank account to qualify you to go back to home, back to God. So just keep putting money in your spiritual bank account. Engage in the activities of this Krishna consciousness movement. Keep doing it day after day, week after week. And we guarantee you, you'll reach a point where you will indeed become qualified and you will enter that ecstatic pada vyama. What is that pada vyama? The spiritual sky. Pada is spiritual and vyama is sky. It's like, what is that demon's name? Vyomasura? It was flying in the air? No, it's a different one. That was Bhoma. Was there a Vyomasura also?
That is said, but he's Bhoma.
Huh?
Bhomasura.
Oh, who was the one who flew in the sky? Took Krishna up in the sky, the whirlwind demon.
He's called Trinavrata.
Huh?
Trinavrata.
So anyway, the spiritual sky is the Pada Vyama. Okay then, anything else? Alright. Everyone's. We'll stop here. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sambal devotees ki jai.